has begun.
We have begun our study of the third return, which is was led by Nehemiah. And so he came back to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. The first return is in 536. Those walls had not yet been built. First thing they did when they got back was they rebuilt the temple. So they built it from 520 to 516 after a delay of some 15 years or so. Haggai and Zechariah came along and stirred them up, and so they got that done. But since then, the walls had still not been built. And I believe that it had been the intention of Cyrus when he first sent the Jews back for them to rebuild the city also, because the temple would not be very impressive out there in the middle of a pile of rocks. So I think that clearly he wanted them to rebuild the city as well, the walls. That had not been done. So Nehemiah comes now in the reign of Artaxerxes Longimanus. He was the successor to Xerxes, and he ruled for 40 years, so 465 to 425. So if you'll think about the return of Ezra in 458, see, look at that. That means that that was within that time, wasn't it? And also, when Nehemiah comes along 13 years after Ezra, that's in 445, that's also in that time period. So those two men did their work within the reign of Artaxerxes Longimanus. Also Malachi, 432 approximately. That's a kind of a guess, but I think it's a pretty educated guess, 432. So if that be the case, then he would also fall within the reign of this king. So this king is the last Persian king during Bible history. And now there continue to be kings after this, but remember that the next period that we study is called the years of silence. And that's because there was no revelation of God, no prophet, nobody keeping a history, an inspired history of God's people during this period. So I hope that everyone understands that. You see, that's why we call this the years of silence. Over 400 years. And there wasn't a prophet, there wasn't an inspired historian or anything like that. So this man here, with the end of his reign, we see the end of the books of the Old Testament and the period of inspiration of the Old Testament. Now, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes is when the book of Nehemiah takes place. It begins, it starts there, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. Now, that's how we come up with the date of 445 for Nehemiah. You know, usually, if you hear a date like that, you just say, okay, well, yeah, I wonder how they got that. Well, this is how we get that, because it's in the 20th year. So you take 20 years from 465, guess what that would be? 445. So that's how we determine when the work of Nehemiah began in coming to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls. So, chapter 1, we've already looked at these first few chapters, so let me just go through these quickly with you, okay? Nehemiah hears from his brethren about the state of the walls in Jerusalem, that they're still just in a mess, still tumble down. He weeps over the state of the city of Jerusalem. So in chapter 2, he is serving before the king, and the king asked him, what's making you sad, Nehemiah? So Nehemiah prays to God very quickly, very briefly, and he requests permission to rebuild the city. And he asks that he be allowed to do it. You know, that's unusual. We pointed out that usually we want to let George do it, or we want to let Bill do it, or somebody else do it, you know. But he says, let me do it. So he asked for the king. He asked the king for permission. And the king gives him permission. So he comes to Jerusalem and examines the ruins of the city just to see what the state of the ruins are in. How much material are they going to be able to use? You know, I mean, you guys would do the same thing when you went around the city to say, I wonder what material here we'll be able to use and how much we'll have to bring in brand new. See, so there were a lot of things. Is any of the wall still standing? How much of the wall is still standing? What about the gates? So he had to examine all of that. And having done that, he exhorts the people to rise up and build. And he tells them that that is the reason why he has come. And he tells them about the authority that he received from King Artaxerxes to come and do this work. So, you see, it wasn't that, hey, I just decided to do this. No, it's God has obviously sped him on his journey, the permission of the king and the authority of the king to get materials. So, I mean, what's standing in the way now? There's nothing standing in the way. So he exhorts the people to rise up and build, and to their credit, they do. They are assigned in chapter 3. We have the assignments of various families to a portion of the wall. And that wouldn't be like a man and his wife and two children. This would be an extended family. You might even call it almost a clan within the family, within the tribe or something like that. So they're assigned their place around the wall. And in chapter 4, the enemies of the Jews seek to ridicule them. They use ridicule as a weapon and threats and intimidation. We're gonna pull sneak attacks on your families out here in their homes while you men are here building the walls. We're gonna sneak attack your families out there. So Nehemiah says, "Okay, bring your families." So they bring all the families, put them in within the walls. Now, yeah, they may burn the houses down or something like that, but the houses were such that they could be built again pretty easily. And that didn't happen as far as we know. But what happened was that when they got all down in the city there, and Nehemiah told the people, "You have your weapons near. Let the builders carry the sword on their side." And he had half his servants keeping guard and everything. So when the enemy saw that it was like a beehive down there, I mean, they were ready for war, they decided to let them build. You know, you want to fight or let them build? Well, they decided to let them build. So, in other words, this is an example of the fact that a whole lot of the time when the enemy blusters, it's bluff. And but now they're ready. See, they're ready for it not to be bluff. And so it turns out to be bluff. And often that's the case. In chapter 5, Nehemiah deals with the usury. Now, what is usury? Bible term that is used. Charging interest. Now, in the law of Moses, Jews were forbidden to charge interest to their brethren. And by the way, there's an interesting thing. Here's just one of those bonuses. Like in the Middle Ages, it was all supposed to be a Christian society. So that meant that among the Christian society, they said, "Well, we can't charge interest. So whom are we going to let? Who are we going to let handle the money and the loaning and everything? Well, let the Jews. See, let the Jews, because they're not Christians, and we're not Jews. So they can loan to us. So." A lot of those banking houses, go back to a Jewish origin with the Jewish people because they let them handle the money since they could loan and make and have usury. They just couldn't do it with one another, but they could do it with the goyim, with the Gentiles. Now, isn't that interesting? So he deals with the usury that, here's the thing about it. The wealthy Jews who had returned would loan money to their poor brethren who were trying to build. Most of the brethren were poor there. And they were trying to get the thing built. So they didn't have time to work on their own farms. They didn't have time to concentrate on their crops to raise money, so they couldn't pay it back. So, okay, well, then your collateral, I'm going to take your collateral then. Well, then they didn't have any way to pay it back. They didn't own their vineyards now. It was taken as collateral and everything like that. So, really, Nehemiah just got all over them. The nobles and the wealthy, and he said, "You give it back." So not only did he have them give it back, but do you recall what else he did in connection with that? Remember, he called the priests and he had the wealthy to swear, to take an oath that they would do it. So it was a public matter of public record, see. So that's a good thing to remember, that even though you say, "Well, I trust you, but I want it in writing." So he trusted them, but he wanted it in writing. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing. Keep the powder dry. So he deals with usury and poverty among the people because they're having a hard time doing the work and building. And he makes the ruler swear to stop oppressing the people. And Nehemiah's own conduct. Do you remember what we pointed out about that? What does it say about his own conduct? He fed 150 at his own table every day. And he did not take the pay that was given to the governor. He was a wealthy man, but he used his wealth for good, didn't he? I mean, that was a lot of money. You support 150 men every day at your table. And didn't take the governor's pay. So he was a wealthy man, but he really, really was a good man. And all right, so here we come now to the part where we got to Wednesday night. Chapter 6. Now this is just classic. The Plains of Ono. And I told you that some years ago, you might not be surprised to hear a preacher get up and he's going to preach a sermon on the Plains of Ono. And what that would be a sermon dealing with compromising the truth. See, that's the idea. Now, it's based on this story right here. So here is the thing. Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem learned that I had builded the wall. There was no breach left therein. Though even unto that time I had not set up the gates, the doors of the gates. Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, "Come, let us meet together in one of the villages in the plain of Ono." But they thought to do me mischief. Mischief does not mean playing a trick on him. This is a serious thing when the Bible talks about mischief. It means an evil turn. Something, they were going to ambush him. They were going to do something. So he says, "Why should the work cease whilst I leave it and come down to you?" And they sent to me four times after this sort. Same way. And I answered them the same way. Okay, now here we get to the juicy part. Then sent Sanballat his servant to me in like manner the fifth time with an open letter. You know what an open letter is for? So everybody can read it. Not just the one for whom it is intended, but anybody who can read that letter. And here's what it said. It's I'm going to put it in a little bit more up-to-date language. Nehemiah, it's going around among the nations, and Geshem thinks so. You and the Jews have in mind to rebel, and that's why you're rebuilding the wall, and you would like to be their king. And you've also appointed prophets. The word is that you've appointed prophets to preach of you at Jerusalem, saying, "There's a king in Judah." And, you know, word is going to get back to the king, Artaxerxes. The word is going to get back to the king about these things. So you better come and meet with us. Does anybody have trouble seeing the veiled threat here? It's not very veiled, is it? Don't you see that? Wow. So, poor old Nehemiah, is he in trouble? Wow. Then I sent unto him, saying, there are no such things done as thou sayest, but you're making them up out of your own heart. You're just making that stuff up. For one thing, Nehemiah probably, and I remove probably, Nehemiah knew Artaxerxes a whole lot better than these guys did. So what are they going to be able to do? Nehemiah knew that. Oh, what a guy. Nehemiah, he knows that. He said, no. Well, the thing continues then. Let's see. All right, so attempt to frighten Nehemiah. Okay, let's go back. Because the attempt to frighten Nehemiah is not over yet. All right, if you want to follow along now, verse 10. I went to the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was confined. Now, we don't know why he was confined. It doesn't say why he was confined. And it seems to have been that he could go somewhere, but anyway, that's all we can tell about he was confined. And he said, let us meet together in the house of God, within the temple, and let's shut the doors of the temple, because they're going to come and kill you. Now, how does it make you feel to be told that they're going to come and kill you? Yea, in the night, they're going to come and kill you. Oh, I can just see Nehemiah shivering. I might be shivering, but he wasn't shivering. Should such a man as I flee? And who is there that being such as I would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. Because who was supposed to go in the temple? In the temple. Only the priest. Only the priest. This is a prophet. This is a guy who is supposed to be a prophet. Shemaiah. No, Nehemiah. I'm really worried about you. I'm afraid for you. We need to meet in the temple. Let's go in the temple and let's shut the doors there. Because they're going to come and kill you. Yeah, they're going to come in the night to kill you. A secret informer. Well, that's what he was. That's what he was. And so he says, I discerned, and lo, God had not sent him. But he pronounced this prophecy against me, and Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this cause was he hired, that I should be afraid, and do so, and sin, and that they might have a matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. Did you hear that Nehemiah went into the temple? I cannot believe he did that. See, get that word going out now. You know, one of the points I've made about Nehemiah is the fact that the devil uses bait. The devil will use bait to catch someone in his trap. Now, he's tried ridicule, and the fear of ridicule. Has Nehemiah taken that bait? Well, see, he didn't go in the trap either, did he? You see, if you don't want the bait, and you refuse the bait, then you stay out of the trap. And here, intimidation and fear, does he fall for that bait? He does not go for that bait. Therefore, he doesn't go in that trap. So that if we keep our hearts right and do that which is right and keep it ever before us, then we will resist the bait that the devil puts in his trap. But if you let yourself like evil things, Not necessarily, maybe evil in every context, but if you let yourself like things or let yourself be moved to fear when you shouldn't be afraid, or to shame when you shouldn't be ashamed, then the devil can use that as bait. So I think that is such an impressive thing about Nehemiah. You know, he didn't just panic. He didn't just panic. That's a good thing to remember. Don't just, you know, I've had to learn. I still kind of panic, but I've tried to learn. And we all need to learn not to panic. But what did he say? I discerned. In other words, I checked it out. I made an investigation. And I found out that the Shemaiah had been hired by Sanballat and Tobiah. Yeah, he had been hired by them. So now I know what he did, why he did what he did. But guess what? Look in verse 15, Ron, 6:15.
So the wall was finished on the 45th day of Luke. It's 52 days.
Now compare that to the how long it takes to build your house. How long does it take to build your house? Now some of you have built a new house or something like that sometime or other. How long did it take? Man, it's 52 days. You know, the enemy didn't have long, did they? That's one of the nice things. When you get the job done, they don't have long to stop you. So they just flew in there, and I mean, they got those walls done. I would imagine that the Jews could see a good reason for doing this. You know, so I think that they would have been on board. We got those walls built, we'll feel a lot safer here in the midst of all these enemies. So I think that would have stirred them up, and so they got on the ball. Now in chapter 7, if you just scanned that chapter, very likely you might think, this is a list of all those who lived in Jerusalem or who were there at the time. Actually, chapter 7. Is a list of the people who returned under Zerubbabel. Under Zerubbabel. In 536. So the number given for those who did return here in this chapter, down in verse 66, chapter 7, it's the same number. Same number as in Ezra 2:64, which is the place where that first return was described. So these are the ones, this is a list of the people who came back that first return. And so in chapter 7 now, look at what they do. Eight. All right, look in chapter 8, and I'm going to let, Jimmy, can you read the last verse of chapter 7 there? And then there's a little more. All right, now the reason why I want to call attention to that seventh month is tell me what was special about the seventh month. Feast of Tabernacles. The Day of Atonement. That was a very special day. That was kind of like the culmination of the Jewish religious year. And so this was a very, very important feast. It was the Feast of Tabernacles. Instead of thinking of the tabernacle as the one that Moses built in the wilderness there, Moses and Israel built in the wilderness, tabernacle in this sense means what? Like a booth or a hut or just a little dwelling place, a temporary dwelling place. So they really kept this thing big time here. They kept that feast very big. And We got, here we go. I was beginning to read in the wrong chapter. All right, look at what they did. The law was read to all the people. The seventh month, the law was read to all the people. They stood and they heard, and the law was read. Travis, would you mind reading? Say verses 2 through 4. Yeah. All right, it read just that next line or two about Ezra standing on a platform. Okay, that's it. So they had made a platform, and he stood on the platform and read the law out loud so that they could hear it. There were few people. In fact, in history as a whole, few people have been able to read. I mean, that's a fact. The great minority of people, or should I say the great majority of people, could not read. That probably would be a better way to put that. So it was read here, and Ezra blessed the Lord. All the people said, "Amen, amen," with the lifting up of their hands. They bowed their heads. They worshiped the Lord. And they went around and they apparently circulated, Levites and so on, circulated among the people, causing them to understand the law. And the people stood in their place. And then verse 8, Donald, how about that? All right, so they explained the what they were reading to the people there, gave them the meaning of it. And all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. That's in verse 9. So he said, no, don't weep, don't weep. Nehemiah, who was the governor, and Ezra the priest, the scribe, and the Levites that taught the people, said to all the people, this day is holy unto the Lord your God. Mourn not, nor weep. For all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. Then he said unto them, go your way, eat the fat, and drink the sweet, and send portions unto him for whom nothing is prepared. For this day is holy unto our Lord, neither be ye grieved, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. So, don't mourn. Do what? Rejoice. Rejoice. And look on down in verse 14. Paul, how about reading verse 14? And so go ahead and read the next verse too. So they went out and they did that. They kept this Feast of Tabernacles as it had not been kept for years and years. Verse 17. Steve Parker, how about reading that? Isn't that amazing? You just find statements like that just peppered throughout the history. They had not done that since the days of long time before. And you just think, well, why had they not? It wasn't for their good. It wasn't for their good. So they kept this feast for 7 days, and on the eighth day was a solemn assembly according to the ordinance, which means in the specifications for the Feast of the Tabernacles, that was the way it was to be kept. So it was a great feast that they had there, and they kept the Feast of the Tabernacles. Now, chapter 9 is a prayer led by the Levites. It is a prayer led by the Levites. It is a public prayer led by the Levites. And it's a long prayer. But wow, is it good. So I want you to listen as we read through this, and I want you to be picking out what it's talking about. Okay, so we start out here, verses 7 and 8. Okay, Jeff, how about reading that? Now, that promise has to do with a land, right? You promised to give them the land. And Jeff, what is that last sentence, that last clause there? So what does that mean? He did what he said. That's right. He did what he said. Now then, you saw the affliction of our fathers in Egypt. That's when they were in captivity, right? In Egypt. Heard their cry by the Red Sea. Now, what did they do at the Red Sea? They crossed the Red Sea. You showed signs and wonders upon Pharaoh and all his servants and all the people of his land, for you knew that they dealt proudly against them, and you got you a name, a reputation, as at this day. So what was that talking about, those signs and wonders upon Pharaoh and all his servants? Yeah, the plagues. You divided the sea before them. Well, we know what that is. You cast into the depths as a stone into the mighty waters. Moreover, in a pillar of cloud you led them by day, and in a pillar of fire by night to give them light in the way. Verse 13, you came down on Mount Sinai. See, everybody following along, we know the history, don't we? We know exactly what happened. You said you spoke to them. You made known to them, verse 14, the holy Sabbath, commanded them commandments and statutes. Verse 15, what did he do? That's right. And what else? The water. And you commanded that they should go in to possess the land which you had sworn to give to them. But what? They rebelled, didn't they? They dealt proudly, hardened their neck, refused to obey. They hardened their neck, and in their rebellion appointed a captain to return to their bondage. So, did God wipe them out? Look at the rest of verse 17, the last half of it. But thou art a God ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, and abundant in loving kindness, and you forsook them not. You didn't quit. You didn't give up on them. All right, in verse 18. Judd, how about reading that one?
Even when they made for themselves a calf of molten metal and said, "This is your God who brought you up from Egypt and committed great blasphemy."
Go ahead in 19.
Thou in thy great compassion did not forsake them in the wilderness. The pillar of cloud did not lead them by day to guide them on the way, nor the pillar of cloud by night to light for them the way of which they were to go.
So even while they were rebelling, what did God not stop? The manna. The manna continued. You know, any day He could have said, "Now, on top of what you have done, I mean, on top of what I'm doing to you, I'm not going to give you the manna for a month." See, He could have done that. Well, then He would have had a whole bunch of dead people. You know, you need to think, and we need to think, what would we have done? You know, dealing with the way we usually react to things when somebody crosses us, would we have been as gracious as God? And let that be something you think about when you hear somebody talk about how cruel God is. You know, remember that He did not. He sustained them in the wilderness. And verse 22, What is that talking about? Verse 22. All right. And namely, who are some, Scott, that are mentioned there? See, that's the Transjordanic kingdoms that they took when they invaded the land. Now, all I'm wanting to do is, can you trace the history that's being dealt with in this prayer here? Pretty easy, isn't it, if you know it? So, and their children multiplied as the stars of heaven. And then he says, okay, you brought them on in. They possessed the land. You subdued the inhabitants. They took fortified cities. And so on. Now, verse 26. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Read that one, Ron. Make the point.
You also multiplied their children as the stars of the heaven.
And what was that promise? You know, Abraham went out, remember God called him out? What did he tell him to do? Look up at the stars. Can you count them, Abraham? No. That's how many your seed are going to be. Okay, that's good. Thank you, Ron. That's definitely relating. We see how the Bible is tied together. It's tied together. Here the strings go all the way back to that promise in Genesis 15. And all right, in verse 26, though, Steve Melton, do you feel like reading? Okay. Verse 26. Go ahead in verse 28 also. Now, what period of history do you think that's talking about? The judges. That's right. So, as he goes along here, I mean, as these Levites are leading that prayer, it gets down to verse 31, nevertheless, in your manifold mercies, you did not make a full end of them, nor forsake them. What had it come to? Captivity. These people had returned from captivity. Why had they been taken into captivity? Because of their unfaithfulness. Now they've come back. So they kind of conclude the thing by saying, now therefore our God, the great, the mighty, the awesome God who keeps covenant and loving kindness, let not all the travail seem little before thee that has come upon us. In other words, it's awfully big to us. Let it not be little. Let it be significant. Since the time of the kings of Assyria, howbeit, you're just in all that's come upon us, for you have dealt truly, but we've done wickedly. So, what are they confessing here? Their sins. Do you realize some of you have been mentioning the prayers? Remember the prayer of Daniel in Daniel 9? Remember the prayer of Ezra? And now here's the prayer of these Levites leading Jerusalem. And in all of those, all three of these prayers, these notable prayers, one of the things that has been done is the confession of sin, right? Confession. Confession of sin, an important thing in any prayer. Did Jesus use a confession of sin in any of His prayers? Why not? He had no sin. That's right. Isn't it interesting that when men pray to God, the prayer, the acknowledgement of sin is a vital part of it? Yes.
This is such a good thing that you said,
That's right. So this prayer led by the Levites, as a result of this prayer, the people covenant, they make an agreement, they're going to keep the law. Now, isn't that nice? They're supposed to have been doing that, but they make a covenant to keep the law. And so in verse 32 of chapter 10, we made ordinances for us to charge ourselves yearly with the third part of a shekel for the service of the house of God, and to bring all the offerings, and that's what they talk about. And the last line, look at that. And we will not forsake the house of our God. We're not going to abandon it. We're not going to let everything just fall apart. Yeah, best wishes. Best wishes. Because they do let it fall apart. I mean right away. Not long at all. Now, chapter 11, we're not going to pay attention much to that. That lists those who are going to dwell in the city rather than out in the country, out in the and outlying towns and everything like that. So, list of those to dwell in Jerusalem. And chapter 12, the priests and the Levites who came up with Zerubbabel. Now, that remember, when was that? When with Zerubbabel? That was in 536. Yeah, 536. That was in that first return. But also the walls are dedicated. So they divide half of them. They go up around one way, walking on top of the walls. The others go up the other way. They're walking on top of the walls. They come and they meet together. They dedicate the walls because this is the kind of thing, God, we're not just counting on these walls here, but we're counting on you for deliverance also. And then in chapter 13, that's the last one. All right, in verse 1, okay, Scott, how about reading verse 1? And go ahead and read verse 2 also. 2 and 3. And read 3 also. Okay, here we go. Now, verse 4. Verse 4. Steve Meeker, how about verse 4? 13:4. With who was Elisha? He was the high priest. He was allied with whom? Do you remember who Tobiah was? One of the enemies. And he had been so nice to Tobiah. He gave him a large chamber, a great chamber, where before they laid the meal offerings, frankincense, vessels, tithes. Wonder why they didn't need it for that. Because they weren't bringing it. All this time I was not at Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, well now that would take us down to about 433, approaching the time of Malachi. I was in Babylon. And I went to the king, and after certain days I asked leave of the king and came to Jerusalem and understood the evil that Elisha had done for Tobiah in preparing him a chamber in the courts of the house of God. Judd, how about reading verse 8? Well, what else would you do? It had to be thrown out. And then verse 9, go ahead, Judd.
Then I gave an order, and they cleansed the room, and I returned there to utensils of the house of God with the grain offering and the frankincense.
That room was not built for Tobiah to have an apartment. That room was built to keep the offerings that were brought in. And own. It's a sight what they were doing here. And they were selling, working on the Sabbath. They were just trading on the Sabbath and everything. So he says, I contended with the nobles of Judah. What evil thing is this that you do and profane the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers thus, and did not our God bring all this evil upon us and upon the city? Yet you bring more wrath upon Israel. So he commanded that the doors be shut, the gates of the city be closed, so there could not be any going in and out and everything. So the merchants and sellers of all kinds of wares, they came and lodged outside the wall. They came, you know, right outside the wall to do business. And he said, why are you lodging about the wall? If you do it again, I will lay hands on you. What were they doing? They were encouraging people to break the Sabbath. Now you might say, oh, Nehemiah was being kind of hard. Well, you know what? The result of not being hard when enforcing the laws of God, yeah, the laws are being broken, and the service of God not being given. Oh, yeah, yeah. Bigger problems later. And then he also has to deal with these mixed marriages and so on. And one last thing here. Elishab allied to Tobiah. All right, one other thing. Offerings had been stopped. Sabbath being violated. Intermarriage with pagan women. One of the grandsons of Eliashib was son-in-law of Sanballat. Now, who was Eliashib? The high priest. One of the grandsons of Eliashib was son-in-law to Sanballat. Can you see why Nehemiah had some problems there? There were these roots and tendrils all in amongst Israel there. And, you know, that's why he was having so much problems. So many problems. Okay, well, we'll stop for today.